Okay, so here we are. Brilliant. So when I was back in Dallas, I put together a little course. When I was still in seminary, I put together a course on how to study the scriptures, how to study the Bible. All right? And if, in fact, if there's enough interest, I'd like to offer it maybe later in the summer or perhaps in the fall. Just toss that out there. But the third lesson, third on this is we would talk about reading biblical passages in context. You see, the Bible is an ancient book written in a foreign language half a planet away from us. And if we do not respect the context, the text that we read and our interpretation of it is often going to say more about us than it's going to actually say about the text itself. So when you open the Bible, we're stepping into a different world with different people, a different time, a different place. So in order to illustrate this, I would use this. Let me show you. Here's my starting exercise. I want all of you right now to interpret the following pictures. You already got a sneak peek there. Okay, the following pictures. All I'm going to tell you about this, these pictures, I'm going to show you a series of about five pictures. All I'm going to tell you is that people from all over the world flock to this one field, and they all lift their hands up. They all do what these people are doing, and most of them end up with a big smile on their face. Okay, now some of you know the answer, so don't cheat if you already know. All right, now I want everyone to turn to their neighbor and say what you think these people are doing. All right, everybody got a guess in? Okay, now let me give you one clue, one big clue. They are in Italy in front of a famous landmark. Anyone? That's what these people are doing. I love that one. Yes, all of these people are pretending to push on or lean into or hold up the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Now, once you hear that, you're like, oh, that's simple. I totally get it. Once you hear the context, it all makes sense. But here's the deal. Apart from that context, those pictures just look silly. To everything, turn. There is a season, turn. Back in the 1960s, there's a passage, Ecclesiastes chapter 3, that became very popular by a band called The Birds, thank you. And then it reemerged in the 1990s with an epic movie, Forrest Gump. This passage became a song, became an anthem, if you will, became really a hippie anthem. And now, I am not that grumpy pastor who doesn't like it just because it's a hippie anthem. I happen to like some hippie anthems. My problem with this is not that it's been used again. My problem is that it's been ripped out of its context and plopped into a modern world so that everyone sees this passage. There is a time for everything, a season for every activity under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill, a time to heal. Everyone hears that and it's familiar and they think they know what it means because they've already planted it into their own context. Today I just want to suggest that maybe, just maybe, Solomon was not just a sentimental hippie. That maybe the context has been lost just a little bit. That maybe because it's become so popular through The Birds and then Forrest Gump and then just our normal knowledge of this is like a coffee mug type passage, that maybe we're missing something and that this passage will be just nothing but sentimental or fatalistic or the soundtrack to your next graduation slideshow as opposed to what God really intended it to be. So before we even look at this passage, I want to lay a little bit of groundwork here today. Let's start with this. Solomon, the author of Ecclesiastes, did not live in Chester County. He didn't live in Wayne, and he didn't even live in Kimberton. And believe it or not, he was not an American. I know. It's disappointing to some people. He wasn't even a Westerner. He didn't speak English, and he didn't think like we think. No one had ever taught Solomon that the universe is the result of a big bang. He never heard that idea. No one ever explained to Solomon that life really just started when there was a big stew of primordial soup and it got zapped. No one ever told Solomon that, you know what, humans are really just the result of random mutations and natural selection. Solomon had never heard those words. Those are foreign concepts. So Solomon was an Israelite who lived in the ancient Near East. So let's set a little context. Why is this important? Because we have different categories. Categories for how we understand life, categories for how we think. We have different questions about life. Solomon does not have the same categories or even questions that we're asking. So let's do it this way. The ancient Israelites did not have categories specifically for things that were what we would call random or natural occurrences. They didn't have a category, a naturalistic worldview. So today, if I were to stop things right now and ask a junior high student to come up here right now, and I were to ask them, okay, why did it not rain this past week? You know, if they're sharp and they paid attention in science class, what would they say? They would say, well, the reason it didn't rain, it had something to do with barometric pressure and the jet stream and things like that. The moisture got pushed to the north of us, and therefore it didn't rain this week. And we'd all be like, oh, they're such a smart student. They've been paying attention in school. But if you ask Solomon this question, he would just be disgusted that we accepted that as an answer. Because that student just told us what happened and told us how it happened through all the science and mechanisms of nature. But that student never answered the question. The question was, why did it not rain this past week? And Solomon says, unflinchingly, because God did not want it to rain this past week. This is a different way, and I'm going to submit to you a better way of viewing life. The ancient Israelites attributed everything from a rainstorm, every sunrise, every flower bloom, every snowfall, every birth and every death, and every famine, and every war, and everything to God. So we live in this scientific age when we are really brilliant at discovering how things work. How does it rain? Or how does smoking cause cancer? Or how do these two little cells become a new human being? We can explain all the processes involved. How and what's happening at every different technical level. But what we're really, really, really bad at doing, and I would suggest you science cannot do, is answer why. Why is a different type of question. Why implies purpose and meaning and design. Why will lead you ultimately, if you keep asking why, it's always going to lead you to something ultimate. It's always going to smack into either our world is just random, it just happened, it's just chance, or our world is a work of divine logic. If you don't believe me, I invite you to come over for lunch and spend about 5 minutes with my 3-year-old. We need you to eat your hot dog. Why? So that you'll grow strong. Why? So that you can live life well. Why? Why? Because I said so! But if you just take a lesson from him, I need to go to work. Why? Well, I need to make money. Why? Why I have to support my family? Why? So I can live my life? Why? If you take a lesson, if you take 5 minutes of your time and just do what Solomon's been doing for the last 2 chapters and ask, why? Why? Why am I working so hard? What am I trying to get out of life? Why are we even here? If you follow Caleb's advice or Solomon's advice, you will always smack into one of two options. Either it's utterly meaningless, everything's just chance, or there's God. He's the reason for everything. Our modern world tells us that there's no meaning or purpose or design in the universe. Whether you personally believe that or not, it's constantly reinforced. Every show you watch on TV, every lesson your kids get at the public school, it's constantly reinforced that you are just a chance accident, that there's just mechanisms of the universe, that there's just things just happen. There's no reason or explanation, so we spend all of our days preoccupied with what is happening and how it's happening and breaking it down to the very specifics, but we never approach what Solomon's really getting at here, and I would say in the whole book of Ecclesiastes, and that is why. The ancient Israelites and Solomon's did not see life like this. They assumed that there must be, there has to be a reason for things. And this isn't easy. If you have spent any time at our church, or if you've read the rest of the scriptures, particularly the wisdom literature, Job, Psalms, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Proverbs, if you read through those, you realize that godly men and women down through the ages have always been wondering, why God? Why is this happening? But notice they always go back to God. They always know that God is somehow involved, that God oversees it. But over and over again, why God? Why am I in this situation? Job. Job is a great man, a godly man who loses everything. And the whole book of Job, if you want to know in one word what the entire book of Job is about, it's one question. Why? And notice Job doesn't get an answer through the whole book. We do, but he doesn't. The Psalms, if you're here last fall, you heard about every other psalm. One psalm is about praising God, and then the next two or three are going to be about why? Why are my enemies succeeding? Why is my life failing? Why am I suffering? Why? And Ecclesiastes, of course, the whole thing. Solomon has done everything he can to create his own meaning, to find his own purpose, and every time it just crashes and burns. He comes up with nothing. He can't work any harder. He can't do any more. He can't sleep with any more women. He's already got 1,000. He's tested everything to its limits. And he's left asking God, why? All of these, though, I want you to see, all of these, take these questions and they lift them up to God. All of them assume that there is a sovereign, all-powerful, personal creator God who oversees every last detail in life. So if you think I'm overstating this, let me run through a few scriptures with you. 1 Samuel chapter 2, this is a prayer of Hannah. Fantastic story, you should read it sometime. But she prays, the Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and exalts. It is not by strength that one prevails. If you want to hear Hannah's statement about life, she says success cannot be found by trying harder. Meaning cannot be found by trying harder. The Lord decides what you get in life. He decides who drives the Kia and who drives the Porsche. He decides who gets laid off and who gets the job offer. He decides who gets cancer and who gets 20 more years. God personally oversees everything that happens in your life. Proverbs 16:33 is great. It says, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. The lot, that's a dice. Says, you know, you might think you're just gambling. You might think when you play the lotto that it's random, that it's just chance. But it says there's no such thing as luck in this world. There is no such thing as chance. God even decides who wins the lottery. Psalm 139, God determined where you were going to be born. He determined what you'd look like. He picked out your personal traits. He decided your personality. He gave you the mix. He put it all together and said, that's good. God chose to make you the way you are. He determined it. Isaiah 46 is one of those just mountaintops of the scriptures. And it says there's nothing that God doesn't oversee in this life. Nothing. It goes into these details. God determines when a bird eats. He determines when a businessman goes on his business trip. He determines the past and he determines the future. Nothing's off limits for him. Nothing can stop his purposes from coming to pass. He personally watches over every person, every event, every detail in life. God's purposes will be accomplished in your life, and yes, they will be accomplished in your death. So one of my favorite passages, Matthew chapter 10, Jesus is getting ready to send out the 12 disciples. He's going to send them out to go heal people and cast out demons and preach repentance and the kingdom has come. Right? So he sends them out and he says, now, I just want you to get ready. On the way, okay, some people are going to want to kill you. But don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. And let me tell you why. Sparrows. You know those little birds that are just like one step above a bug? Those little sparrows. You know what he says about them? He says, my Father in heaven watches over every last one of them on planet Earth, and not one of them falls to the ground unless he says so. If my Father treats a bird that is like a bug that way, do you think that anyone could take your life from him? Do you think that anyone could harm you without him overseeing it? No. You will die on the day that God says you may die, and not a moment before and not a moment after. You're in his hands. This God of Solomon, this God of the scriptures, he is all powerful, he is all knowing, he is ever present, he is eternal, he's inescapable. His purposes and plans cannot be stopped, and nothing happens in this life without his permission. So let me ask you, who brings life and who brings death? Who brings joy and who brings sorrow? Who brings feast and who brings famines? Who causes the sun to shine and the rain to fall? Who gives us seasons of life? Now let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. There is a time for everything, key word here, and a season for every activity under heaven. There is a time to be born, a beginning, and a time to die. There's a time to plant and a time to harvest, to uproot. These are seasons of work here. There's a time to kill and a time to heal. I grew up on a farm. I know what this means. Even if you think, do you kill someone? There are times when animals are so injured or they're so sick, you put them down. And there are times you bind them up and you heal them. There's a time to tear down and a time to build. There's a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather them, a time to embrace and a time to refrain, a time to search, and a time that you just need to give up. That the searching's done. There's a time to keep and a time to throw away. Jenny prefers keeping. I prefer throwing away. There's a time to tear and a time to mend. There's a time to be silent when nothing you say will help. And a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. I want you to listen to this in the context of the God that we just heard about, the God that we've seen across these scriptures, the God that Solomon knew and knows. What is this list? Is Solomon some sentimental hippie just talking about all the things that happen in life? No. This is a list of times that are given by God. Solomon is leaning into something here, and I want you to see it. He is leaning in to an all-sovereign, all-powerful God. God has set a time to be born and a time to die. God has set a time to plant and a time to uproot. God has set a time to kill and to heal. God has set a time to tear down and to build. God has set a time to weep and laugh. God has set a time. God has set these times. God brings these times into your life whether you want them or not. God has a purpose for every one of these. And when you look at these, you're like, well, we don't get a say in it. And at least half these things are things that we don't want. I don't want to mourn. I don't want to weep. I don't want to die. I don't want to kill. I don't want to hate. You know what I want to do? I want to laugh. And I want to dance. I probably want to dance more than you guys do. I want to love. I want to embrace. But here's the thing. I don't get a say. God has set a time for me to go through things that I would never choose. And no matter how hard I try to work around it or avoid these things in life, I don't get to determine the purpose of my life. God does. In verse 9, we're going to see that Solomon brings all of this to a conclusion with this one line. What do workers gain from their toil? And the answer is clear. Nothing. Like, you gain nothing by trying to create your own purpose in life. No matter how hard you work, you get what God gives you, nothing more, nothing less. That's what you get in life. This is a heavy passage. I don't know about you, but it sets off all kinds of questions in me. Questions that I cannot answer. Like, how can a good God send these awful things into our lives? There's a scene in John chapter 9 when the disciples ask a question basically like this. They walk in and they see this man begging along the road, and he's blind. And they say, Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents that he was born blind? Like, why was he born blind? Why has he been here for years and years and years, sitting in his own filth, unable to work, unable to produce anything in life? He's born blind. He's been there for years. Well, who sinned? Why is that? Why did that happen? Now, for us, that's just a weird question. We would say, well, there was a problem, physical problem with his eyes. It has nothing. We would go into some scientific answer for why he's blind. But not the disciples and not Jesus. I want you to listen to what Jesus doesn't say here, if you can hear that. He does not say, in John chapter 9, when he answers them, he doesn't say that God had nothing to do with it. He doesn't be like, what? He's born blind? Oh, that just had something to do with his eyes. Who knew? We're all surprised by that. Listen to what Jesus says. He says, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in him. And then Jesus healed him. God had a purpose for the man's blindness. Now, I don't want you to miss this. Jesus doesn't deny that it was part of God's plan. That from the beginning, God determined that this man would be born blind. That he would spend years sitting in his own filth, begging, unable to produce anything, being led by the hand for years and years. So that Jesus could heal him that day. I don't know what this story does to you, but when I hear that God can take things like blindness and sickness and death and hurt and hardships, and he can take those in our lives and use them for his glory, I am floored. On the one hand, I want to worship a God who can do that. That all these bad things we see in life, he can use those. Those are part of his purpose. And on the other hand, I just want to puke. Because if he can do that to that guy, he can do that to me. He could choose to give me a handicap. He could use suffering and hardship and death to glorify himself through me. Solomon's going to feel the same way. Look at verse 10. I have seen the burden that God has laid on the human race, on men. This whole issue is horribly weighty. It's a horrible burden. And yet, he has made everything beautiful in its own time. It's this horrible weight that is absolutely beautiful. God has made everything, life and death, mourning and dancing, laughing and weeping, cancer and health. God has made everything beautiful and its own time. This is one commentator uses it as this, that God takes all these strands of life, all these times, these seasons, these events, and each one's a new thread that he picks up and he's weaving into this tapestry. That each one adds a new dimension, a new color, a new flavor to this huge picture that everything, when you step back and you look at it, you're going to say, that is beautiful. Somehow God is weaving together all of our hurts and our pains and our joy and our laughter. That it's not just beautiful in spite of the hardship, but somehow it's beautiful with the hardship. Somehow God is even using the things that we would never choose, mourning and death and war, for his beautiful purposes. So last month I was at the Balfours. And there's a group of us sitting there, and they had us answer this question about when was the time when you grew most spiritually or you most felt God at work in your life? And we're all ready for big encouragement. We sat around, we went around the group, and you know what? Every person, it was like death and tragedy and brokenness and sin and shame. And I mean, we went around the stories, and it was just awful. Every single person, it was like cancer and plague and black death. And it was just every single person, they pointed to the time when they most felt God at work, when God most moved in their life, was the darkest, hardest, saddest times of their life. As a pastor, I thought, well, I need to completely rethink how I'm doing this. Stop all this good feeling stuff. I need to just come out and just ruin your lives. Then you'll see God at work. God can use everything, make everything beautiful in its own time. This still leaves a lot of questions. I have no idea personally how God can make some things beautiful. I mean, the death of a child, the bombing in Boston. I mean, I'm too close to it. I mean, there are things in my own life that I look at and I say, I have no idea how God could possibly make that beautiful. I'm sure all of you have that same questions. But Solomon does too. He has also set eternity in the human heart, in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning. And here's what Solomon says. That's it. Like, you are created in the image of God, and everything within you says everything should connect. Everything should have a purpose. Like science and philosophy and art and everything should come together in this beautiful, beautiful piece that all of history and my life, everything should make sense. You're born with that in you. You know that it's there. But we can't fathom it. We're too close. It's like this giant stained glass window, and all we can see is this one little broken piece of glass. But you have to step back to see the work of art. God's work can only be seen from an eternal perspective, and we are way too close. But every once in a while, when we get a little bit of distance, every once in a while, I feel like God gives us a glimpse. There's one of my favorite stories. I've talked about her a lot. Corrie Ten Boom. She's the author of a book called The Hiding Place. She, Christian, beautiful Christian woman who ended up in a concentration camp during the 1940s, Nazis. And so she's put into this concentration camp, and she describes her story. It was really just this awful, one tragedy after the next. And at one point, her and her sister are moved into this just wretched, wretched barracks. And there are more than 100 women shoved in there. And she describes this bedding that is just atrocious. It's straw, and it's just matted down with human filth and oil and sweat and stench. And they're all supposed to sleep in there. The stink alone, like, she can hardly sleep in there. But she goes in, and within a few days, she realizes, like, the whole place is just plagued, infested with lice. And at one time, They're sitting down there, and you'd have to read the story. Her sister is really pretty unbelievable in this story. Corey is understandably exhausted, frustrated, I mean, ready to melt down. And they're sitting down there to, they had a few little scriptures that they'd smuggled, and they read some scriptures and pray daily. And her sister says, "We should thank God for everything today." And her sister starts praying and actually thanks God for the lice. And this is the part where Corey just completely melts down. Like, completely frustrated, completely exhausted, cannot believe. Like, how could you possibly be thankful for lice? Like, God, you've already crushed me. You've already taken everything away from me. You're already killing people. I'm in this hole, and now there are lice that are plaguing me. And then a week later, they heard from the other women who stayed in the other barracks that the guards were going systematically through all the barracks, raping every last woman. But they skipped her barracks because it was full of lice. That God in his goodness had sent an infestation of lice to save them from the horror of rape. Every once in a while, we can just get a little glimmer. Now, what if she had never heard that story? What if she never knew that the guards were coming to rape? She might have just been bitter and angry and thought God hated her and never knew that one of the most gracious acts of God's love and kindness was to send lice to plague her. Maybe. Maybe God has sent lice into your life. Maybe cancer is a gift from God. Maybe times of mourning and weeping have some purpose that you're just too close to see. Maybe it's a thread that if we just step back a few decades or millennia, that we would start to see what God is doing all around us. Solomon's going to plead with us. If we would just trust God, that he is good, that he is all-powerful, that he is in control of everything, if we would just receive it all as a gift from God, then we could finally let go of trying to control our lives and enjoy it for what it is. Look at verse 12. "I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in his toil. This is a gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does that so that men will fear, they will revere, they will worship him. That you'll come to an end of yourself and realize that there's nothing you can add. And you will worship him. Because that's what we were created for. Whatever has been, already been, and what will be, has been before, and God will call the past to account." So here's the one place, though, where we actually have a real advantage over Solomon. Here's the one place where Solomon can go this far, and he says, I don't know why, but I have to trust God. Because if I don't trust God with my life, that he is over all the good and all the bad in my life, then my life is just completely meaningless. But if I trust him, I can receive it as a gift. Here's the one place where we actually have an advantage, though. We've seen God take the worst things in this world. We've seen God take humiliation and betrayal and suffering and mockery and the execution of the Son of God. The worst thing that this world has ever seen, we've seen God already take that and turn it into the most beautiful thing this world has already seen. We've seen that the Father uses servanthood to bring freedom. We've seen that he uses humiliation to exalt us. We've seen that he uses poverty to share with us his riches. We've seen that he uses a cross and death to bring us life. Now, if God could bring freedom and glory and riches and beauty through the cross of Jesus Christ, do you just maybe think that you can trust him with your hardships? with your mourning, with your burden. Sarah was just a little girl, but she was born blind. And when she turned 8 years old, there had been medical advances at that point. I think this was the 1980s. And there had been medical advances, and they were actually able to do an implant where she was, like, if things went well with this surgery, she was actually going to be able to see for the first time. So they went through this big process, and her parents were so excited, and just being a parent of a little girl, I can only imagine. So they had the whole day set. She went through the surgery, it went successful, they thought it was going to go well, and she was all bandaged up for weeks and weeks, and they had timed it so that when they would take off the bandages, they were excited about the first thing she'd ever see. So they stood her in front of this huge bay window that overlooked this field with flowers, and the sun was shining. It was a day like today. And they unwrapped the bandages. And the first words out of this little girl's mouth were, "Why didn't you tell me it was so beautiful? Why didn't you tell me?" And like tears streaming down their face. You know what the parents said? "We tried. We tried, baby. We tried." What if maybe, just maybe, if we pulled back not just weeks or decades or millennia, but we pulled back into eternity, that at that day that is already set, that we are going to meet our Maker, what if we're greeted by a Father who says, "Come here, I want you to see this. I want to see what I've been doing all this time, how beautiful I've made things." I believe, based on the promises of God, that we're going to look at that and we're going to say, why didn't you tell me it was so beautiful? And he's going to say, "I tried. I tried." But until that day, we have to live by faith. We have to live in a life that is full of good and bad, life and death, mourning and weeping. I don't know where you're at today, but I know a lot of you are in the middle of some heavy burdens of life, to use Solomon's words. Some of you are in the middle of mourning. Some of you are in the middle of hardship. Some of you are in the middle of suffering. Some of you have things in your life where you are bitter at God. And I just want to plead with you that maybe, just maybe, God gave that to you as a gift. And he's making something beautiful out of it. I'm going to encourage you to just listen to the song as the worship team comes out and leads us. Just reflect on that. See what God's doing in your life. Father, God, I just pray for faith. Faith to trust you when we can't see. Faith to trust you that your view truly is better than ours. It's bigger than ours. Father, I pray, Lord, that for those of who are in the midst of suffering and hardship and death and things, Lord, that they do not know or understand, God, I pray, God, that you would give them the faith to cling to you. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.